Hello, and welcome to the New World. Episode 11, A Brand New Spain. Last time, we covered the calamitous collapse of the Aztec Empire, the destruction of the city of Tenochtitlan, and the surrender of the Emperor Cuauhtémoc to the conquistador Hernando Cortés. It was a short war, but thanks to the massive help of native Mexican allies and a very convenient smallpox epidemic, Cortés had triumphed over the Aztecs. Now all of central Mexico was his to command. Or so it appeared. The reality was, from the very moment Cuauhtémoc surrendered to Cortés, the Spanish had a very precarious position in Mexico. Though they had technically conquered an empire, it's not like the entire area had suddenly become Spanish-speaking, God-fearing, tax-paying subjects. Cortés had a great many problems he needed to solve, and over the next 10 years or so, he would have to make great strides to transform this thoroughly foreign land into something more familiar. If he failed on any one of these points, the Spanish could be quickly forced out by the Mexicans. The first problem was the most obvious. Where would Cortés place his capital? I know that sounds like a somewhat superficial issue, but a ruler needs a place with the resources to administer his country. He had two real choices, Veracruz and Tenochtitlan, now Mexico City. Veracruz had only just been founded and was far away from the center of political power in Mexico. However, it was full of Spanish settlers who were no doubt more loyal to Cortés than his newly conquered subjects. The other choice was, of course, Mexico City, the former capital of the Aztecs. Cortés chose the latter, but not immediately. The city was in dire straits after its siege. For months, it had been the host of armies who had fought on its streets and murdered its citizens. It had also been host to a deadly epidemic that killed a third of its people before most of all of that even happened. Although it was in tatters, Cortés saw the value of having the former Aztec capital as his own. After all, it had once been bigger than most cities in Europe at the time. Therefore, he temporarily based his capital in Coyoacán, a suburb of the city that he now set to work rebuilding. No one construction project was perhaps more important than the religious centers of the city, though. The Spanish had immediately outlawed human sacrifices in their new territory, so the grand temples of Tlaloc and Huitzilopochtli, collectively known as the Templo Mayor, were torn down under their orders. In their place, and with many of the same stones, Cortés ordered a new Christian church founded in its place. More on that later. Not only that, but many Renaissance Spanish buildings were also constructed in the city center. This was naturally due to the help of thousands of indigenous laborers, but also because of many newly arrived artisans from Europe, who instructed their underlings on the latest building techniques. Within 3 years, the markets of the city, which had long been a staple of Aztec life, reopened, and the new Mexico City became just as much as the administrative and economic capital that Tenochtitlan had once been, fit for Spanish rule. The second major issue was that the local people did not trust the Spanish as administrators of their old territory. To solve this, Cortés more or less puppeted the old Aztec infrastructure, waving it around like a corpse Weekend at Bernie's style. Within the new Mexico City lay the old Emperor Cuauhtémoc, now a prisoner of the Spanish, just like his predecessor Moctezuma II. Unlike Moctezuma, however, no one would be barricading the Spanish in Tlaxcalans into his palace and coming to his rescue. Instead, the defeated emperor did what his conquerors told, and his people followed him. Utilizing the local leadership was key to ruling Mexico. The Spanish were only a few thousand in number, even still. And after European plagues devastating the population, there were still millions of people scattered throughout the countryside in cities and villages, places the Spanish hadn't even visited yet. The solution was simple. Make the Mexican nobility Spanish nobility. Noblemen who worked with the Spanish were converted to Christianity, given Spanish names, and sent back to govern their territories more or less as before. Townsend gives the example of a local nobleman named Chimalpopoca, who took the name of Don Alonso de Castañeda after a conquistador present at his conversion. Over time, these men might be required to lead their peoples to more populous cities, where the Spanish could have greater control over them. However, as much as he found local nobility useful, there were some noblemen he could not allow to retain their power, and there was no better example of this than Cuauhtémoc. Despite the fact that the monarchy back in Spain saw the Aztec royal family as their peers, Cortés only ever seemed to see them as threats to his personal political position. In 1524, Cortés learned that one of his lieutenants, who he had sent to explore Central America, might have instead been wanting to conquer the territory in his own name and set up an independent area. Even though this was exactly what Cortés had done to Governor Velázquez in Cuba, he could not allow something like this to happen. I mean, whatever happened to loyalty? He decided to set off and personally deal with the situation, and he decided to take Cuauhtémoc with him. After all, if he left the emperor in Mexico City, he might plot to escape and stage a rebellion. However, not too long after leaving the capital, Cortés promptly accused Cuauhtémoc of plotting to escape and stage a rebellion. Whether the emperor was actually planning on doing so didn't really matter, although personally, I wouldn't blame him for taking the opportunity. The Spanish expedition had Cuauhtémoc and a few companions tortured and hung from a tree, an ignoble end for the last Aztec emperor. On top of all this, Cortés learned that his lieutenant had been killed by his own men earlier, making the entire trip pointless. As you could probably guess, Cortés had a third problem, namely that of his own men. You see, the conquistadors had endured much to help their leader conquer an empire. As such, and like any soldier would rightfully do, they expected to be paid a great deal for conquering such a wealthy foe. This was a promise that had been implicitly made since Cortés first set out from Cuba in 1519. And so, in order to maintain the loyalty of his own men, it was a promise he needed to keep. He did so in a multitude of ways. The most simple of these was through the material wealth of Mexico. Through Malinche, still acting as interpreter for Cortés, the Spanish traveled through the many city-states now under their control and demanded payment, more specifically in gold. They also requisitioned native women to keep as slaves and treated them so poorly that King Charles himself had to give an order to Cortés to rein in his men. Occasionally, when Cortés was in need of cash, he also sold some of his new subjects into slavery in the Caribbean. Gold and girls would satisfy many of the men, but Cortés's more powerful underlings would no doubt require something more. Therefore, Cortés decided to expand the encomienda system. If you listened to episode 5, you'd know that the encomienda system was a system of labor wherein the Spanish could essentially extract wealth and labor from the native people of their granted territory. In return, theoretically at least, the natives received the great rewards of Christianity and the Spanish language, in addition to protection from bandits. Cortés handed out towns and villages as encomiendas to his subordinates, and as thanks for their service. There was also the added benefit that the new encomenderos, who by the way were heavily armed and armored Spanish knights with their own military retinues, would do just about anything to maintain their newfound power and owed their wealth to Cortés. This meant that Cortés's political power over Mexico could be even further cemented. It wasn't just Spaniards who became encomenderos, though. In fact, it wasn't even just men. Two of Moctezuma II's daughters, Doña Isabel and Doña Leonor, were granted encomiendas of their own, ensuring that the House of Moctezuma would remain landed nobility in Mexico. In fact, the House of Moctezuma remains nobility in Spain to this very day. There is perhaps no more famous of an encomendero, though, than Malinche, also known as Doña Marina. The former slave had been rewarded well for her services to the Spanish during the conquest. By the mid-1520s, there were many more people who by now knew how to speak both Nahuatl and Spanish, but Cortés kept her around for other reasons. In 1523, she gave birth to their son, Martin. This was around the same time Cortés's wife, Catalina, finally arrived from Cuba, only to die under suspicious circumstances not long afterwards. Whether Malinche was actually in love with Cortez was never in question. She was only one of his great many mistresses, if you could even call them that. She was later married off to one of Cortez's lieutenants, Juan Jaramillo. She bore him a daughter and died in 1529 from a European disease. All this, and she was less than 30 years old. Cortez seemed to love their son, though, and Martin Cortez became one of his favorite bastards. Of course, he had several others, including a daughter with Isabel Moctezuma. Cortez's compatriots also continued the conquests out of their own accord, in order to expand their personal power and that of Spain. One example of this is Nuño Beltrán de Guzmán, who made a push to the west, conquering as far as the province of Nueva Galicia on the west coast. He did so with the help of a few hundred Spaniards and several thousand indigenous conscripts. One of the biggest things that Cortés needed to do to cement power in Mexico was to oversee the beginnings of a mass conversion to Christianity. While many local people were happy to embrace Jesus as one god among many in their pantheon, they certainly weren't happy with the idea that they needed to abandon all of the others. Back in Europe, the Protestant Reformation was now well underway, and Catholicism was facing a great deal of internal strife. A few million converts in the New World would surely help bolster church power if some were lost to Lutheranism in the Old World. To that end, the papacy sent over a special mission of 12 clerics to meet with the indigenous religious leaders and work out a plan for the conversion of the people. These were not stuffy old bishops or ostentatious cardinals, however. These were monks of the Franciscan order. Founded by Saint Francis of Assisi, the Franciscans were, and still are, dedicated to preaching Catholic doctrine whilst ideally living in humble poverty. The Spanish and the Vatican knew that if they were going to convert millions of people, they needed men who knew Catholicism inside and out, and who were good at teaching the tenets of Christianity to others. Though the mission was sent by the Pope, all 12 men were Spanish. The Franciscans are actually going to be the first of several religious orders that will come to Mexico to preach, including the Jesuits, the Dominicans, and others. The meeting, well, actually, several meetings, took place in Mexico City in 1524, and it was likely that Malinche acted as interpreter. Our source for this meeting is Bernardino de Sahagún. Though he was not actually present, Sahagún knew 10 of the so-called 12 apostles. He also could speak Nahuatl, and personally interviewed 4 of the Mexican priests present at the meeting. The Spanish argued that the Aztecs worshipped false idols, and that this angered the Christian God. "You have caused him an injured heart," they said, "by which you live in his anger, his ire." God was angered so much by this that he sent the Spanish. "Those who afflicted you with tormenting sorrow, by which ye were punished, so that you ceased these not few injuries to his precious heart." In short, the reason they lost their war against Cortez was because they had not embraced Jesus, and that by accepting the one true God, they would be able to cool the heart of he by whom all live, so he will not completely destroy you. If you couldn't tell, I was intermixing some quotes from the source that I read. To all this, the Mexica didn't directly argue. They couldn't win a game of our God is better than your God, because, after all, Huitzilopochtli did not save them from the war that conquered their empire, or the plagues that were killing so many of their people. Instead, they argued this, and here comes a really big quote. "You have told us that we do not know the one who gives us life and being, who is Lord of the heavens and of the earth. You also say that those we worship are not gods. This way of speaking is entirely new to us, and very scandalous. We are frightened by this way of speaking, because our forebears, who engendered and governed us, never said anything like this. On the contrary, they taught us how to honor the gods, and they told us that through our gods we live and exist, and that we are beholden to them. They said that these gods that we worship give us everything we need for our physical existence. It would be a fickle, foolish thing for us to destroy the most ancient laws and customs left by the first inhabitants of this land." End quote. This was a clever argument. The Aztec priests were equating their pantheon with core aspects of their culture, something incredibly valued by their people. The implication here is that even if the 12 apostles managed to convince these priests to embrace God, the same simply could not be said for the rest of the people. And if a mass conversion was attempted all of a sudden, the Spanish would be courting open rebellion in Mexico. Rather than take such a direct approach, the Spanish instead decided to take things slower. If these priests found their gods to be so key to their culture, perhaps their children would find it a little easier to ditch the old ways. So, they founded the first of many missions on the North American continent in Mexico City, Texcoco, Tlaxcala, and Huexotzinco. Sorry. From here, church officials could coordinate their efforts in building churches and converting locals across the land. Mission churches also acted as homes for the many religious orders making their way into Mexico, but would also later act as outposts for Spanish colonization. Americans, for example, might recognize San Diego, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and San Antonio as cities that once began as Spanish missions. These missionaries also established schools, where sons of local nobility could be taught to write in Latin, speak in Spanish, and worship in a church. However, while their intentions may have been peaceful, their methods were not always so. If a local village didn't want to relocate their populace to a nearby mission, they might find a band of soldiers galloping into town ready to force them out and burn their houses to the ground for good measure. Anyone who didn't stop sacrificing would also be executed. Finally, the cathedral in Mexico City, that one that was built from the old temples of the Aztec gods, would become the seat of an archbishop. I won't say too much more about the Christianization of this territory, mostly because it's a long process, but there's one more thing I wanted to mention. In 1531, the Virgin Mary came to visit Mexico. She appeared to a local farmer named Cuauhtlatlocatzin on the hill of Tepeyac, almost within sight of Mexico City. She asked him, in his native Nahuatl language, to build a church there for her. This peasant, known to the Spanish as Juan Diego, managed to do so, both with the help of his uncle Juan Bernardino, who had been healed from a fatal disease by the Virgin, and also by the new Archbishop of Mexico City, who became convinced of the farmer's words after Mary also revealed an image of herself on a cloak. This apparition of the Virgin Mary became known as Our Lady of Guadalupe, and she is easily one of the most recognizable religious images in Catholicism today, becoming immensely popular throughout Latin America. Her basilica in Mexico City is even the most visited shrine in all the Christian world. I'll talk more about Latin America and Christianization in a later episode, but just know that only 10 years after Mexico was conquered by the Spanish, it had already had a few miracles of its own. Cortes had solved many of the immediate problems he faced in suppressing a potential native revolt. However, despite this, he didn't manage to keep his command for long. After the misadventure that was the expedition to Honduras and the death of Cuauhtémoc, Cortes faced a lot of backlash from his political rivals. They saw him as attempting to rule Mexico all by himself without any royal oversight, which he'd basically been doing since 1521. In 1527, a high court, or audiencia, was established to get control of civilian administration and keep it out of Cortes' hands. The following year, Cortes got on a ship with his son Martin, the one he had with Malinche, and he went to Spain and pleaded with King Charles himself to fix the situation. He had won this territory that was already being called the Kingdom of New Spain. He deserved to rule it. The king gave Cortes the magnificent title of Marques of the Valley of Oaxaca, which allowed him 23 encomiendas and 23,000 people under his personal control. However, The king didn't give him anything else, including control of Mexico. Cortes would continue to explore and get wealthy, but he would never again repeat his successes. Jumping a little bit ahead, in 1535, the Viceroyalty of New Spain would be created. This was part of a larger organizational system that was being formed in the wake of the Spanish-American conquests. Once these conquests are a bit more finalized, I'll talk more about them. Just know for now that the government of New Spain now answered only to the government of regular Spain. I'd like to leave things there for now. A lot happened over the 1520s in this region, and the transition from the Aztec Empire to the Viceroyalty of New Spain was not a simple or easy one. The old indigenous government was replaced, and the Aztec religion was being suppressed. Encomiendas had been set up across the land, and the Spanish had not only consolidated their power, but were actively expanding it. The New World was beginning to seriously change in a number of ways, and the effects of Spanish colonization would reverberate across the hemisphere, even to places the Spanish hadn't even heard of. Places like, for instance, the Andes Mountains, and the massive empire that ruled them, known as Tahuantinsuyo.